Russia continues to amass forces near Europe's largest nuclear power plant.
There are in total more than 40 units of military equipment, which is now located on the territory of the station. Also, there are 16 military vehicles near the first power unit and seven near the second one.
Plus, the United Nations expresses concerns over alleged plans to put Ukrainian prisoners of war on trial. And later in the program, what is Russia's fire hose of falsehood?
It comes from just the incredible volume and the wide range of channels and that Russia uses for its propaganda. And when I say channel, I don't just mean like a traditional TV or radio station. I mean all possible intersections.
Today is Tuesday, August 23rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine's military said that Russian forces carried out fresh artillery and airstrikes in the Zaporizhia region, where fighting has raised concerns about safety near Europe's largest nuclear power plant. It comes a day before the country celebrates its 31st Independence Day, and joining us from Kyiv is Anna Chernikova. So, Anna, Ukraine is saying that they are seeing additional Russian forces in and around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. What exactly are they saying, and what are they seeing, because they have not held that plant since March of earlier this year?
Well, according to Energoatom, today it was an official report, and they say that Russian forces are accumulating equipment on the territory of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and has increased the number of troops at the station. According to their report, there are in total more than 40 units of military equipment, which is now located on the territory of the station. Also, there are 16 military vehicles near the first power unit and seven near the second one. Russian forces also brought 12 pieces of equipment under the overpass, and it was also mentioned in their report that Russian forces have added a considerable number of soldiers on the territory of the plant.
And finally, Anna, I wanted to ask you this. You know, here we are on August 23rd, Tuesday. It's Ukrainians' Flag Day. And on Wednesday, the 24th, is Independence Day. It's the country's 31st Independence Day. And I was wondering what you're seeing there in Kyiv in terms of how people are celebrating today, because there have been numerous warnings, not only from the United States intelligence community, but also from Ukrainian officials, that there could be a possibility of Russian activity. And there's some warnings going out in terms of trying to get people not to aggregate in large groups. So how are people marking this occasion?
This is actually true. People are really informed, and people were informing for the past weeks that these 2 days, and especially tomorrow, August 24th, are pretty much under the highest risk of massive missile attacks. And I can say that a lot of people, citizens of Kyiv, have left Kyiv to the countryside areas, for instance. So if you look today around the city, there are much less cars, and a lot of people, especially people with children, are trying to spend this, well, let's say holidays, so-called, yeah, but they try to spend all these days in the countryside or out of Kyiv, as also was recommended by a lot of governmental officials. Again, it's no panic in Kyiv, so I cannot say that people are actually panicking, but people are on the alarm, this is for sure. People understand that there is a high risk, and everyone are getting ready for tomorrow in particular, and people, at least this is, you know, what is planned and what government is asking for, will probably be more attentive to air raid sirens. The main event probably, which is actually happening, even it is online event, but it is a Crimean platform. It's second time that this event is happening, and a lot of high guests are participating in this event. Today, the president of Poland, Andrzej Duda, arrived to Kyiv to be present personally, physically at the event, and he met President Zelensky. They even had press conference outside of the government building. But he is, as we know for the moment, he is the only one who actually is joining the event physically. All the rest are joining it online.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your reporting today.
Thank you, Steve.
Many Ukrainians are also already concerned about the aftermath of the war and its effects on its population. From the Associated Press, Karen Chamas continues our coverage.
In the Kyiv suburb of Bucha, Father Andrei prays at the vast expanse of a mass grave behind his church. This grave contained 116 people, including 30 women and 2 children, but there was not only one mass grave. Father Andrei has conducted many burial services for civilians found shot dead or killed from shelling in the streets of Bucha. Some were found dead in their cars as they tried to flee the violence. Father Andrei worries about how Ukrainians will cope when the war ends and they come up for air. For now, we are surviving on adrenaline, but after everything that's happened, I'm worried that the aftermath will last decades. I'm Karen Chamas.
The United Nations Human Rights Office says Russia and its armed allies in Ukraine's Donetsk region are planning to put Ukrainian prisoners of war on trial, which could amount to a war crime. Lisa Schlein explains.
The trials reportedly could take place in coming days in Ukraine's port city of Mariupol. The UN Rights Agency expressed concern that POWs charged with a crime will not receive due process and guarantees of a fair trial to which they are entitled. UN Human Rights Spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says under international law, POWs have combatant immunity. She says they cannot be prosecuted for having participated in hostilities or for having committed lawful acts during an armed conflict.
No sentence or punishment may be passed on them unless it is delivered by an impartial and regularly constituted court. We recall that international humanitarian law prohibits the establishment of courts solely to judge prisoners of war, and that willfully depriving a prisoner of war of the rights of fair and regular trial amounts to a war crime.
Shamdasani calls Russian authorities' refusal to grant independent monitors confidential access to prisoners of war very worrying. She says that leaves POWs open to torture to extract confessions from them.
And of course, we're very concerned that there are these photos and video footage that are emerging of cages being built in Mariupol's Philharmonic Hall to put on show these prisoners of war, which is, of course, humiliating as well.
She says the construction of cages, coupled with inflammatory public statements by high-level Russian officials and members of affiliated armed groups, are also cause for concern. She says statements labeling Ukrainian POWs war criminals, Nazis, and terrorists undermine the presumption of innocence before trials have taken place. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Microelectronics made by companies in the United States and its allies are crucial components of Russia's war systems that are being used in the invasion of Ukraine. That's according to an investigation by Britain's Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI. Henry Ridgewell reports that Moscow may be struggling to keep up with chip demand as global sanctions continue.
Ukraine says Russia fired more than 3,650 missiles and guided rockets into its territory in the first 5 months of the war. Most of the weapons are highly reliant on Western-made microelectronic technologies, says RUSI report co-author Gary Somerville, who asked VOA to conceal his face for security reasons.
It doesn't appear that they actually have the ability to sort of reproduce to the same level of sophistication and at scale of a lot of these critical microelectronics. These are the ones that would be absolutely essential for example, like precision-guided munitions.
That includes Russia's Iskander 9M727 cruise missile, one of its most advanced weapons. RUSI researchers were able to recover some missiles in the field inside Ukraine and inspect the microelectronics inside. they found several Western-sourced components, including digital signal processors, flash memory modules, static RAM modules, and Ethernet cabling that originated from American, Dutch, and German companies. Russia's KH-101 cruise missiles, some of which targeted the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, were found to contain 31 foreign components.
They are quite prosaic and quite, in many ways, somewhat ubiquitous. They can be found like in any sort of, you know, any sort of electronics, really. You know, microwaves, dishwashers.
Such microelectronics were freely available to Russia before its invasion of Ukraine. However, Russi also identified at least 81 components classed as dual use and subject to US export controls. They include a high-performance microchip found inside a handheld navigational system used by Russia's special forces to estimate coordinates for precision artillery and airstrikes. Japan was the second largest supplier after the US. Many of the microelectronics found in the weapons were decades old, and following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February, many states have banned the export of such components to Russia. Moscow has long used elaborate methods to procure technology, says Somerville.
It's through the use of a number of front companies that, on the surface, when you conduct a due diligence check, appear to be sort of legitimate, but in reality can be somewhat affiliated with companies, large Russian companies that are essentially members of the military-industrial complex.
The US and its allies have imposed sanctions on Russian weapons manufacturers and companies supplying them with components. They need to be tightened, says Somerville.
What the sanctions and effective enforcement of these sanctions can do is raise the costs on Russia to acquire these particular microelectronics that they do need.
The report's authors say Russia is now scrambling to procure microelectronics in bulk, and its military could be permanently weakened if the supply can be cut off. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Tokyo.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Russia asserted earlier this month that Javelin anti-tank missiles were ineffective. Polygraph.info explains why that claim is false.
On August 10th, Russian state media claimed that U.S. defense contractor Raytheon admitted its Javelin anti-tank missiles were ineffective. The supposed expose came after the United States announced $1 billion more in military aid for Ukraine, including 1,000 javelins. The Russian stories began on RT, Russia Today, with a piece headlined, quote, "The Fall of St. Javelin, Why the Javelin Has Proven Ineffective in Ukraine." RT claimed documents from Raytheon showed that javelins are inferior compared to similar weapons. That is false. Military analysts say the Javelin has been a game changer, allowing Ukraine to wipe out whole columns of Russia's best tanks. The reference to St. Javelin reflects the missile's popularity in Ukraine. A depiction of Mary Magdalene holding a javelin has become an iconic symbol of resistance to Russia. Ukrainians have written songs about St. Javelin, and videos of javelins exploding Russian tanks are all over social media. Raytheon disputed the RT claim. Those documents were not created by our company, and the efficacy of the Javelin speaks for itself, a Raytheon spokesman told Polygraph.info.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website that's produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation as well as misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. So, what makes someone believe misinformation? Christopher Paul is a senior social scientist at the RAND Corporation. He and co-author Miriam Matthews wrote, quote, "The current Russian approach to propaganda builds on Soviet Cold War-era techniques, with an emphasis on obfuscation and on getting targets to act in the interests of the propagandist without realizing that they have done so." End quote. That passage is from a 2016 essay that they wrote entitled "The Russian Firehose of Falsehood Propaganda Model." That was well before Moscow's current wave of aggression on Ukraine. I caught up with him in his office in California earlier today, and I asked him where this fire hose analogy came from.
Yeah, so it comes from just the incredible volume and the wide range of channels and that Russia uses for its propaganda. And when I say channel, I don't just mean like a traditional TV or radio station. I mean all possible intersections or combinations of modes or media. So a single false persona managed by a Russian troll is a channel. And so a single Russian troll might manage a dozen or more channels. And then there's all the actual channels. There's the RT and the fact that RT is in something like 30 languages and the various different Sputnik radios and then all the different unacknowledged radio sources where Russian money is paying for a radio station without that being acknowledged. And some of them you can dig and follow the financial trail and say, oh, this is actually a Russian-funded media station. Some of them it's harder. They're more heavily obfuscated. So just the incredible volume and then just the complete lack of commitment to objective reality. All the BS that is spewed by these different Russian propaganda channels. And so fire hose of falsehood seemed like an apt analogy.
So that brings up my question because, you know, a couple of the subtitle areas within your essay were Russian propaganda makes no commitment to objective reality and Russian propaganda is not committed to consistency. So I guess the question I have for you is this. Why would someone believe in something that isn't consistent and isn't demonstrably true?
Yeah, that was my question, too. So when I first encountered this approach to propaganda, this Russian fire hose of falsehood that has four properties, that it's high volume and multi-channel, that it's rapid, continuous, and repetitive, that it makes no commitment to objective reality, that is, there's a bunch of falsehood baked into it, and it makes no commitment to consistency, I thought, wait a minute, I come from an influence and persuasion background that says that credibility is king and the truth always wins. Isn't that so? And it looked to me back in 2015 like Russia was enjoying considerable success with this falsehood-based propaganda model. And that's when I enlisted the aid of my colleague Miriam Matthews, who's a social psychologist. And I said, hey, let's dig into the existing literature on influence and persuasion and see who's right. Is my hypothesis that the truth will always win the right one? Or is this Russian fire hose of falsehood model more effective and persuasive? And we ended up writing this paper because of what we uncovered. And, well, fellow humans, I have some bad news. We are not very good. We are very vulnerable to being manipulated.
So where does influence and persuasion fit into things? Because, you know, VOA, as part of its charter, is to present objective, balanced, and comprehensive reporting so that people can have a picture of what's really going on. So in terms of disinformation, where does that influence and persuasion things come in there when you have actors who are spreading things that are either demonstrably not true or are shaded in some kind of gray areas?
So it's complicated because truth-telling is important and truth-telling can be persuasive, but don't mislead yourself into thinking that what you do is in some way magical, that just because you're telling the truth that you are more persuasive. In fact, the liars have a bunch of advantages. And so we collectively need to think about how do we go about this? How do we tell the truth more and quicker and more robustly in the face of all these liars? And if you'd like, I can go through some of the advantages psychologically that a propaganda approach like Russia's fire hose of falsehood enjoy.
Yes, absolutely. Please share.
Yeah. So starting at the top, kind of the high volume and multi-channel, there's no surprise that quantity has a quality all its own, so that the more modes and media you're in the social psychology literature, familiarity is influential. So the more times you've heard something from the more different places, the more likely you are to believe it. The other thing that's hugely important in the volume and multiplicity of channel space is all the social psychology studies on persuasion find the single most important factor in persuasiveness is whether or not the source is like you. And if you could see me, you would see that I'm making air quotes around like you because the various different dimensions of sameness or likeness that can be mobilized are very different. It can be that you like the same sports team or that you like the same band or that you come from the same hometown or that you both like blondes or all these different dimensions of likeness that are easy to mobilize in fallacious manners, right? So I'm a Pittsburgh Steeler fan because I lived in Pittsburgh for 20 years. Well, if someone has an online avatar that is the Pittsburgh Steelers logo, I immediately feel a little bit of kinship with them, whether I actually share any kinship with them and whether they've posted that avatar sincerely or not. So that's potentially persuasive. And so think about, what are the odds that one of the avatars or channels or modes or spokespersons of all these different Russian channels is in some way like someone in the audience versus the chance that you, as a single reporter, as a truth teller on VOA, are like any given member of your audience. It's just a numbers game. You're disadvantaged.
Christopher Paul is a senior social scientist at the RAND Corporation, and we'll pick up part two of our conversation tomorrow, where we discuss not only what is gaslighting, but also how to combat misinformation. Steve Brodner is a well-known American illustrator, cartoonist, journalist, author, and educator, but his latest cartoons have also been focusing on Ukraine. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
He's got prominent cheekbones and a long nose. He's kind of simple to draw.
Just a few lines on a sheet of paper, and it's easy to guess who you're looking at. Art and politics definitely mix in this small studio in Upper Manhattan.
Remember, employees must wash hands, and you'd see that in the restrooms of restaurants. So here's the world. Ukraine is cracked open, the blood is spilling, and he's washing his hands with the blood of Ukraine.
Steve Brodner is considered one of the most prominent and successful political cartoonists in the U.S. He has an innate sense of how to illustrate the world's most important topics, from America's internal political issues like gun control, election campaigns, and abortion rights, to international politics.
And Putin as the Jolly Roger.
For the past few months, Brodner has focused his art on the war in Ukraine.
In some ways, it's getting worse because it's turning into a long, drawn-out stalemate where Putin wins this and then he loses that.
In early April, Brodner made a collage for the Los Angeles Times called Putin the Great, Emperor of All Russia.
The final picture is the image I showed you before about the John Hartfield image where he's got a big meat axe and he's the butcher of Ukraine.
Brodner has a large collection of works dedicated to the war. Every new tragedy he transforms into a picture, documenting crimes against Ukraine and condemning Putin. Cartoons in general tend to exaggerate events, but in Ukraine, there's often no need for exaggeration.
Here's a man grieving over his son.
Mariupol, yes.
You could see he's holding the boy's head in his hands and he's crying. Bomb that came down at the railroad station. So people took pictures of the missile that came. And it said, for the children. Somebody could actually do such a thing. To say, here's the bomb for the children. I just don't understand anything anymore.
But every day, as more disturbing news come in, Brodner sits down at his desk and fights Russian disinformation the only way he knows, with a pencil. For Nina Vishnyova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba 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 zip. DC.